On cue, you guys are, wow, I'm flustered. I don't know, this is great. Sometimes you don't get nervous. Man, I'm nervous today for some reason. I don't even know what's going on. Actually, we're starting our fourth segment in our journey through the Gospel of Luke, and we're calling this Breaking Point. If you're reading the Gospel of Luke, or if you've read through the Gospel of Luke, you know, Jesus is doing his thing at a particular pace, but then you get to the final week before he goes to the cross, and it accelerates. He's like, he's going, he's pressing in, he's pushing, and he is making very clear what his objectives actually are. What his agenda has been all along, what the new kingdom is actually going to look like. He said it, he's communicated it, and so now he's not pulling any punches. He's all out communicating very clearly who he is. And I don't know about you, but when we think about breaking point, I sometimes have the image of a rope in my mind, all right? And I think we've got a picture there, right? This image of a rope, that you're to the point where you're just about to bust. You're about to break. You're about to fall apart. And it's this breaking point where maybe financially we're in so deep we can't survive, and it's gonna break, right? Or if not financially, maybe with your employer, and you're just sick of the job. You're sick of what's going on. You're sick of the expectations. You're sick of the pay. You're sick of all these things, and you just get this breaking point. Maybe it's with your spouse. Have you ever felt this way? Don't answer that. Actually, don't answer that. But have you ever felt this way with your spouse? Or maybe not with your spouse, with your kids. Where you're just at a point where you can't do it anymore. You're just kind of over it. Maybe you felt this way emotionally. Maybe you've even felt this way spiritually. So that's one image that I have when we come to breaking point. Another image that I have for breaking point is a chain, and a chain being broken. And in this idea, this is good. I think this is a positive thing, right? Maybe we're breaking free finally of our addiction, or maybe we finally experience some sudden success and we feel good about what we've been doing and how we're doing it. Maybe we're finally overcoming some obstacles and this feels really good, and this chain that seems to be connected to this big weight is finally broken and I'm free and I'm experiencing all of these things. And so in our journey of following Jesus, the greatest triumph was Jesus' resurrection. And I need us just to know that. And we're going to celebrate that in just a few weeks on Easter Sunday. But here's the deal. The resurrection is not the ending to a really great story. It's not the ending. It's actually the beginning. The resurrection is the beginning. The resurrection starts this new creation, this new thing, and it's a new beginning. As a matter of fact, this is what the prophet Ezekiel actually communicated in chapter 36, verse 36. It says this, "And I will give you a new heart, and I will give you a new spirit. I will put this within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh, and I will give you a heart of flesh." We just finished miracles, right? The signs of the kingdom. This is possibly, in my opinion, the greatest miracle ever, when God takes our hearts of stone and softens them and makes them hearts of flesh. So when I think about breaking point, which is the title of this series, I'm not thinking about finally being fed up enough to a breaking point, or to have the chains finally breaking from something that's holding me back. Although these are true for humanity, these are true breaking points, I'm thinking of something a little bit different. And so for our message, I've got to spend a little bit of time on that, and then we're going to look at the text, and then I'm going to make some very pastoral observations. If you're looking for my normal teaching, I've tried all week to make this that fit my mold and how I like to do things, but I just can't, because I think there's something here for us. So when I think of breaking point, I'm thinking about encountering Jesus in maybe the darkest moments of my life. Really, really in the depths of disappointment and depravity. I'm thinking about the moments in life when we are given a faith to believe, a faith to trust, and a faith to follow, despite what we see and who we are, despite how difficult and how dark things might actually get. And I'll explain why I think this way, And the darkness in our lives and the world takes space in our lives. Have you ever noticed that? We give free rent to the world all the time. We give free rent to the ways of the world, the arguments of the world, the fights of the world. We give free rent all the time in our lives. We give the darkness in our lives a lot of space often. But often in the confusion, darkness, and disappointment in life, we buy into the same lie that Adam and Eve bought into in Genesis chapter 3 when the serpent tried to convince them they don't really need God. And I don't know if you know this or not, but if you've been following Jesus, this is a tendency for us. This is the temptation often where we think, I've got that, I don't need him. We don't necessarily say that, but we certainly live that way. This is within my wheelhouse. I'm an expert in this. I've got this. I don't need him. Or things are so bad we get angry at God and we think, where are you at? What are you doing? We're frustrated with you. I don't need you anyway. I don't need your help, God. I can have enough trouble of my own. And we begin to think this way. And think about it. We can't even keep promises that we make, let alone keep all the commands that God has given us. We are broken vessels. We are broken people. We are not what we were designed and created and intended to be, which is absolutely beautiful. And so we have all of these challenges. And so, full circle here, I think the greatest proof of the resurrection, look at the disciples. They failed and failed and failed again. They fled and took off when Jesus was arrested, when he was tortured, when he was dying in the most humiliating way. The only one there was John. They thought Jesus was leading this political rebellion against the established order, but they were wrong. And so on Palm Sunday, everyone celebrated Jesus in this triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And yet, at the end of this moment, when everybody's celebrating, we read that Jesus wept. He wept. And Jesus wept because he saw that the lips of those who praised him were potentially going to be some of the same lips that would shout, "Crucify him," in just a few days. Not even a week later. And so Jesus wept for Jerusalem, a city that would endure many betrayals, a lot of different corruptions, and his followers would be powerless to protect. And those who betrayed, those who ran away, those who could not be courageous when courage was needed, something happened to their hearts after the resurrection. They experienced the light, and the light came into them through Easter morning. The rock was moved, and the seal was broken, beginning their journey of this new creation, this promised thing that the resurrection gives us. And for us, through those cracks of our broken journeys, with the pieces of our own hearts shattered on the ground sometimes, we journey by God's grace into this new creation, this new promise that's been sealed and guaranteed through the resurrection. And God sees beyond our shattered lives and our remains, and he picks them up and he sings over them. And then he sings over us. And this is the breaking point that I'm talking about. Will we let him do that? And I know breaking can sound terrifying. How many of you love to be broken? Anybody? Yeah. Yeah, how many of you have some sort of ailment going on right now and you're just broken and you don't like it? Yeah, we don't like it. We don't like to be broken. And so it sounds terrible and hard and painful. It feels like a lot of failure and a lot of loss. But a few days later, the resurrection was just the beginning. It was just the start. So I want us to ask ourselves a question that we're going to ask throughout this portion of Luke's study. And it's a simple question, although it's got a lot of depth to it. And the question is this: am I following Jesus where he is actually going or where I think he's going? There's no doubt in my mind that most of us in this room, I would say all of us in this room would say, yes, I'm following Jesus. And are you following Jesus where he is going? Or are you following Jesus where you think he's going? Where you want him to go?
There's a significant difference. There's often people I talk to, there's no doubt they're following Jesus, but Jesus is going that way and you're going that way. Maybe a different way to ask this question is, am I truly following Jesus or am I just following my expectations of him? Am I following Jesus where he's going, or am I following him based on what expectation I have for him? And I'll follow him as long as he goes where I think he should be going. As long as he's doing the things that I think he should be doing. Am I following Jesus as he is, or am I following Jesus as I've imagined him to be? Am I following or am I aligning my life where Jesus is leading, or do I actually want to lead him? And so to set up Luke chapter 19, we need to remember how oppressed the Jews are. Rome is in control. Their taxes are overwhelming. The laws are crushing them. They have no national pride whatsoever. They are desperate for a Messiah who will come and set them free. They're desperate for this. And it's actually about Passover time, and people have a sense that something is going to happen. Something's going to happen that they've been hoping for decades and even centuries. And so Jesus shows up, and the crowds react in the most appropriate way, all for the wrong reasons. And I wonder if we do that. I mean, they believe Jesus will become king, and they believe Jesus is going to set them free, but they are disappointed because Jesus is going where they think he should be going. But maybe Jesus isn't going that way. The Jews, they want a savior from Rome, but Jesus, he wants to save the world. And this is going to create major conflict for Jesus in the last week of his life before the cross. And so let's dig in. Luke chapter 19, verse 29 says this, "When he drew near to Bethphage and Bethany, the mount that is called Olivet, he sent two of his disciples saying, 'Go into the village in front of you, where on entering you will find a colt tied, on which no one has ever yet sat.'" That's a hint that could be problematic. Does that make sense? "So untie it and bring it here. And just in case anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' you shall say, 'The Lord has need of it.' So those who were sent went away, and they found it just as Jesus had told them. And as they were untying the colt, of course the owners said to them, 'Why are you untying this colt?' And they said, 'The Lord has need of it.' And they brought it to Jesus, and throwing their cloaks on the colt, they lifted Jesus up, and Jesus sat on it." So you got this picture? You're one of the disciples. Jesus says, "I want you to go, and I want you to go to this particular place, and I want you to get this particular colt, and I want you to bring it here. And if anybody asks you, this is what you're going to tell them." And somehow, through the power of the Holy Spirit, the owner is going to say, "Okay." Right? Like, you can take it. Nobody's ever sat on it. Nobody's ever ridden this colt. And they get it to Jesus. They take off their cloaks. They put it on the back of this colt, and Jesus gets on it. Jesus gives very specific instruction. He tells the disciples where to go. He tells them what they're going to find and how they're going to find it and what to say if anybody asks any questions of them. And this goes exactly as Jesus said. And Luke wants us to know, even if we doubt it, that Jesus is absolutely in charge this week. Because as we read the last week of Jesus' life, we're going to have a tendency to feel that, man, what is Jesus doing? Jesus, just be quiet. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to do... Jesus, why are you going to fight with those guys right now? Jesus, if you keep doing this, somebody's going to kill you. But we need to know, and Luke wants us to know, Jesus knows exactly what he's into. He knows exactly where he is going. And Jesus isn't some passive victim headed to the cross. He's actually in the driver's seat, pressing the pedal straight to it. And Jesus is the promised king. And even in this moment, this event, Jesus is fulfilling what Zechariah prophesied In chapter 9, verse 9, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming, righteous and having salvation. He is humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." The entire idea of the colt instead of a war horse, because Jesus is declaring that his kingdom is peaceful, not militaristic. In the ancient world, kings rode horses into war, but they rode donkeys in times of peace. And Jesus is declaring what he's always declared through everything he's done so far, that this is the kind of king I'm going to be, and you're not going to change it. You're not going to sway me. You're not going to mold me. You're not going to try to reshape me. This is who I am. And Jesus intentionally chooses humility over political power, remind us again of what kind of king he actually is and what kind of kingdom he's actually going to lead. And so then verse 36 says this, "And as he rode along, they spread their cloaks on the road. And as he was drawing near, already on the way down the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of his disciples began to rejoice and to praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works they had been seen. And they were saying, 'Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King who comes on the earth. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest.'" And we know how confused they all are, because we know what's about to happen in less than a week. We know. And here are the crowds of people declaring Jesus their king in their minds. They'll finally get what God's promised. They'll finally be out of oppression from Rome. They'll finally not be burdened with the taxes. They'll finally be able to be a mighty, strong nation again. Finally, about time God shows up and gives us what he's promised, or at least what they thought God had promised them. And with Jesus in power, finally Rome can be conquered, taxes be lowered, again they can be the strongest, and all the other nations can bow down to them. That's what they had in mind, and Jesus was their way to get this. Jesus was going to accomplish this. What they want, Jesus isn't bringing. Yet in this moment, they're all out for Jesus. And I want to be really careful here, because I took a tangent and I started studying, and from what I can tell, Jesus knows this. He seems to embrace this celebration. He doesn't tell them to stop. He doesn't reject them. He doesn't deny them. He seems to embrace this celebration. What we can say when looking at the other gospel writers, there are people who are now willing to embrace and follow Jesus because he's going to meet the expectations that they have for him. But in just a few days down the road, Jesus will be crucified. And so the big question for me is, what changed? What changes over the next 5 days? 6 days, what changes? These people are so excited about what they see and what's happening here, what they think Jesus is going to do for them. And they're so excited that they actually sing straight from the Psalms, Psalm 118, verse 26, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is he. We bless you from the house of the Lord." Of course. However, there's always a downer in the crowd, isn't there? Always. You always have to have the downer. And I love Luke's gospel because he always points out that the downer just is a downer. And you're just always going to have the downer. But he doesn't give a lot of attention to the downer either. But here it is, verse 39. "And some of the Pharisees in the crowd." Some. And some of us are that guy. You know what I mean? Like you're sitting in a conversation, you just got to be that guy. And here's the guy. He says, "Rebuke your disciples. Rebuke them." And Jesus, I think he says one of the most brilliant things right here. And I think that sometimes we miss how brilliant this actually is. He says, "I tell you, if these people were silent, the stones would cry out. I think this is loaded. I think this is one of the most firm verses Jesus ever spoke. It is definitely the most firm verse in this particular section. The grumblers want the celebration to stop, and they want it to stop right now and immediately. They do not want Jesus to be declared king because they've already decided what the crowd doesn't know, that he isn't the king they want. And so you got a large crowd who are bowing down to him. They're celebrating him because he might be the king that will finally give them everything they want. But then you got the grumbler who might be true, who's already decided that isn't the kind of king we want. We want a king on a war horse, not on a donkey. And so you stop this nonsense right now. And then Jesus makes one of the most clear, most firm statements. He cuts straight through the nonsense, and he declares again boldly about who he is, where he's from, and what he's going to do. And all of this isn't up for debate. None of it is based on anything the people are going to do. This is God's movement. And like other places in Scripture, if humanity won't or humanity can't, creation will. Creation joins us in our moans and groans. Creation shouts out. And so when humanity can't and humanity won't, guess what? The rocks will. And right here, Jesus makes it very clear. And it fits so well with what Luke has been telling us all along. Remember? Do you remember the miracle when Jesus calmed the storm and the disciples said, "Whoa. The waves and the wind obey him." Even when humanity doesn't recognize the king, creation will. The rocks and the stars and the animals in the sea and the birds of the air, they will bow down and declare him king. And I do think it's a little funny that rocks seem to understand things religious folk can't. I'm just saying. What Jesus is saying is, "I am king. I am king." And they don't get a choice in the matter of his kingship. They don't. They'll be able to decide whether or not they're going to follow him and submit to him and to surrender to him. But Jesus here is strong, and he is committed to his mission and to his agenda throughout the entire Gospel of Luke. And Jesus right now isn't desperate for any attention because he is so sure of what he is about to do and so certain of what he has accomplished. And like I said last week, it's just a good reminder, it's always better to worship Jesus and give him thanks. I hope Jesus never has to say to you, "Oh, you're not going to worship me and give me praise? Then the rocks will." And if we don't, then creation will. The weird thing is, Jesus doesn't need us to worship him. He invites us to worship him. And then we get this, verse 41. "And when he drew near and he saw the city, he wept over it." That's it. And so I think this whole triumphal entry, and I know for a lot of us, we've heard it for a lot of years. You could probably tell me the story. If we were just to sit down out in the foyer and I say, "Tell me about the triumphal entry," most of us would be able to say something about it because we've heard it so much, have we not? But I really think this triumphal entry is the climax of Jesus' ministry. I really think that it's the climax of his life. What began in the synagogue in Nazareth in Luke chapter 4, he is moving forward like he had planned to do from the very beginning. And Jesus knows exactly what's ahead of him. Jesus now in his final week is leading to the cross, but he continues to announce what his kingdom is all about and how his kingdom is going to be designed and how his kingdom is going to look. And God has been at work. He's been at work through Jesus to heal and to save and to set free and to rescue and to declare the year of the Lord. And the enemy and the religious leaders, They're there to oppose him. They're set to oppose him. And as people are traveling to Jerusalem toward the Passover, this pivotal moment, this special moment for Jesus, he isn't going to be stopped from celebrating the Passover and recognizing all that God has done. And he has apparently taken some time, and he's set up some time to prepare for it. He even knew where to find a colt and what to do with the colt. And Jesus chose this young fowl, probably a donkey's colt, just like was prophesied. And then they lay cloaks, their garments, along the road for Jesus. And then you can almost picture it, because as they start down this steep hill, down into the valley, the crowd starts to sing. This would have been a familiar song that they would have sung every time they were on journey to Passover. And Jesus, he embraces this moment because he really is the fulfillment of all of their real hopes. He really is. And they have longed for a king, and now the king is here to bring peace from heaven to earth. The problem? The grumblers, complainers, the know-it-alls. They don't like what's happening. And they feel compelled to say something. And Jesus knows, Luke knows, and we actually know, because we have the whole Gospel of Luke, what's ahead for Jesus as he approaches Jerusalem. And from Jesus' perspective, this is why they're celebrating in the first place. God is bringing salvation, and he's bringing salvation through Jesus. Why wouldn't they celebrate if they only knew what Jesus had been actually talking about all along? How much more would they be celebrating? And here's the deal. This is going to be a breaking point. It is. It's going to be a breaking point. Not just for the disciples, not just for the crowd, not just for the religious elite. This, if you really dig into this, is a breaking point for you and me too. It is. Because as Jesus goes into Jerusalem, the same questions are going to press us. They are. Are we going to ride along in this faith and this hope that Jesus will somehow fulfill my hopes and my desires? Are we ready to sing songs and praise no matter what? Or are we only going to sing songs of praise as long as Jesus seems to be doing what I expect him to do? When I want Jesus to change my circumstances, when I want Jesus to change my relationships, when I want Jesus to heal my body and give me the promotion and the raise that I deserve, or when I want Jesus to change the people around me, but he doesn't, will I trust Jesus even if his agenda isn't mine? See, our temptation is like the Garden of Eden. We have a tendency, when things don't go our way, to think, I don't need God. I don't need God. Maybe life would be easier without him. Maybe I could cause this much trouble on my own. Maybe I'd actually get in less trouble if I wasn't following Jesus. And because we have this tendency that was introduced to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, where we think we don't need God, then do you know what we tend to do when Jesus doesn't follow our agenda, doesn't do the things that I expect him to do? We reshape him. We weaken him. We reduce him down. We do it all the time. More than most of us will recognize. I see on social media all the times how we try to reduce Jesus down into our political ideology. All the time. And he said, I won't fit. I won't fit. My way is different than your way. I see Jesus all the time being reduced down to simply justify my preferences. I like things a particular way, and I can find a verse to prove it. It happens all the time. We want Jesus to make it easy on us, comfortable, convenient. And we perpetually have this habit of reducing him down and reshaping him to be the kind of God who's going to make my life easier and better. And we do this. We reduce Jesus down, we reshape Jesus down to validate the version of life that I want. Will I follow Jesus even when he isn't who I want him to be? And will I follow Jesus even when he doesn't do what I want him to do? And will I worship Jesus even when things like life doesn't go the way I want? There is a breaking point. And this long road into Jerusalem is going to give us a little bit of time to figure it out. It's going to give us a little bit of time to see what our motives actually are for following Jesus. Are we ready to lay our cloaks on the ground, on the road in front of Jesus? On Palm Sunday, it was so easy, so showy, and so extravagant. Will we also follow Jesus in the midst of trouble and controversy and trial and death? Will you follow Jesus not just when it's easy, when everybody else is doing it? Or will you follow Jesus even into trouble, even into controversy, even into trial, and even into death? Don't be so quick to answer. Because as we're going to see, Judas didn't. As a matter of fact, Peter didn't either. As a matter of fact, none of the other disciples did except for John. They hit the breaking point and they couldn't handle it. When it came time to actually decide whether Jesus was king or not, eleven of the 12 people who spent every single day of their life for the last 3 years with him said, "I can't." And so what makes me think I can? What makes you think you can? When Jesus doesn't do what I want him to do, am I sold out? Am I willing to lay my cloak down and to worship him when it's just me and things aren't going the way I think Jesus should be making them go? The breaking point is real. And it happens when our version, our expectation of Jesus encounters the true King Jesus. The crowd wanted a king, not the cross. The crowd wanted a throne, not a grave. The crowd wanted comfort, not the forgiveness of their sins. The crowd wanted a platform, not surrender. And I'm praying for you, and I'm praying for me that over the next 5 weeks we have a breaking point sometime in this series that pushes us to finally once and for all decide that Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and I am with him no matter what, through it all, a breaking point to the end of our false expectations, our self-reliance, and our terrible idolatry. If any of us are following Jesus, a version of him that we have created, there will be a breaking point for you. And I would love to say that your faith is strong enough that at that breaking point, you'll be all in. But part of reflecting on the triumphal entry this week was me thinking of a lot of people, even people who had been a part of our own church family, leaders in our church, who when it came to following Jesus completely said, and if you've been around Mountain View for 40 years, you know there were breaking points. And you know there were some who said, I'm all in, and there were some who said, no, thank you. We're going to face these breaking points. And when we create a version of him, of our expectation, we're going to have to come face to face with the reality that Jesus cannot be redefined, he cannot be reshaped, he cannot be rebranded as anything less than king. And so Palm Sunday, I think, forces a decision. And it's okay if you can't make a decision today. You have 4 more weeks. I just am telling you that the triumphal entry is the easiest week because everybody else is doing it. You get to chapter 20, 21, and 22. It's not comfortable, people. Jesus goes all out and reminds people, you can't define me and my kingdom. And he says some things in the next couple of chapters, chapter 20, 20, 21, and 22, that, whoo-wee, you might crucify him. And so let me ask you the same question I asked at the beginning. Am I following Jesus where he is actually going or where I think he's going? You need to know that Jesus is headed straight to the cross. You need to know that. We have the luxury of knowing where he's going. He's headed straight to the cross, a path that leads nowhere else except to death. Are you on that journey with him? Or have you created some ideal Jesus that you're following that doesn't lead to the cross because the path is straight to the cross? The life with Jesus is a life to death, a life to surrender, a life to sacrifice, a life to serving so much that it might actually cost you your comfort and your convenience. It might actually cost your life. Are you on that journey with Jesus? Because that's where his road is taking him. Or have we put Jesus on a horse instead of a colt, expecting him to be a warrior in my life, to deal with my nasty neighbors, to take care of all the wretched sinners, to just slay them out? If you just get rid of them all, God, life would be so much better. Which version of Jesus are you willing to take your cloak off and lay on the ground for? So we're going to go into our communion time, knowing that the triumphal entry was a road that led straight to the cross. I would encourage you to ask these questions as you eat the bread and drink the juice. God, am I walking in your will, or am I just walking in my understanding of it? I would challenge you to ask, am I surrendering to where you're going? Or am I trying to fit you into my journey? We know the benefits, don't we? Of the broken body, of the poured out blood. It gives us a little bit of a benefit knowing what the cross actually accomplished. But even knowing what the cross did for you and me, are we actually willing to take up our own? Are we actually willing to follow Jesus to death, to sacrifice, and to surrender? He was completely broken and he was completely poured out. He modeled for us what the posture is in his new kingdom. Eat the bread, drink the juice, remember he's king and he is worthy and he has bought his position with a price. There's a table back here, one up there, a couple over here. Take a few moments, eat the bread, drink the juice. Remember, you're free to go.